State importantly that other developments would be transmitted as they occurred. Then there was dance music, and Ebling Miz threw the shield that cut the power. Toran rose and walked unsteadily away, without a word. The psychologist made no move to stop him. When Beta stepped out of the kitchen, Miz motioned silence. He said, "They've taken Haven." And Beta said, "Already?" Her eyes were round and sick with disbelief. "Without a fight. Without an unprint..." He stopped and swallowed. "You'd better leave Toran alone. It's not pleasant for him. Suppose we eat without him this once." Beta looked once toward the pilot room, then turned hopelessly. "Very well." Magnifico sat unnoticed at the table. He neither spoke nor ate, but stared ahead with a concentrated fear that seemed to drain all the vitality out of his thread of a body. Ebling Miz pushed absently at his iced fruit dessert and said harshly, "Two trading worlds fight. They fight and bleed and die and don't surrender. Only at Haven, just as at the Foundation." "But why? Why?" The psychologist shook his head. "It's of a piece with all the problem. Every queer fact is a hint at a nature of the mule. First, the problem of how he could conquer the Foundation, with little blood, and at a single blow, essentially, while the independent trading worlds held out. The blanket on atomic reactions was a puny weapon. We've discussed that back and forth till I'm sick of it. And it did not work on any but the Foundation. Randu suggested..." And Ebling's grisly eyebrows pulled together. "It might have been a radiant will depressor. It's what might have done the work on Haven. But then why wasn't it used on Mnemon and Iss, which even now fight with such demonic intensity that it's taking half the Foundation fleet in addition to the Mule's forces to beat them down? Yes, I recognized Foundation ships in the attack." Beta whispered, "The Foundation, then Haven. Disaster seems to follow us without touching. We always seem to get out by a hair. Will it last forever?" Ebling Miz was not listening. To himself, he was making a point. "But there's another problem. Another problem. Beta, you remember the news item that the Mule's clown was not found on Terminus? That it was suspected he had fled to Haven or been carried there by his original kidnappers? There is an importance attached to him, Beta, that doesn't fade. And we have not located it yet. Magnifico must know something that is fatal to the Mule. I'm sure of it." Magnifico, white and stuttering, protested, "Sire, noble lord, indeed I swear, it is past my poor reckoning to penetrate your wants. I have told you what I know to the utter limits, and with your probe you have drawn out of my meager wit that which I knew, but knew not that I knew. I know. It is something small. A hint so small that neither you nor I recognize it for what it is. Yet I must find it, for Mnemon and Iss will go soon, and when they do, we're the last remnants, the last droplets of the independent Foundation." The stars begin to cluster closely when the core of the galaxy is penetrated. Gravitational fields begin to overlap at intensity sufficient to introduce perturbations in an interstellar jump that cannot be overlooked. Toran became aware of that when a jump landed their ship in the full glare of a red giant, which clutched viciously, and whose grip was loosened, then wrenched apart, only after 12 sleepless, soul-battering hours. With charts limited in scope, and an experience not at all fully developed, either operationally or mathematically, Toran resigned himself to days of careful plotting between jumps. It became a community project of a sort. Ebling Miss checked Toran's mathematics, and Beta tested possible routes, by the various generalized methods, for the presence of real solutions. Even Magnifico was put to work on the calculating machine for routine computations, a type of work which, once explained, was a source of great amusement to him, and at which he was surprisingly proficient. So at the end of a month, or nearly, Beta was able to survey the red line that wormed its way through the ship's trimensional model of the galactic lens, halfway to its center, and say with satiric relish, "You know what it looks like? It looks like a 10-foot earthworm with a terrific case of indigestion. Eventually, you'll land us back in Haven." "I will," growled Toran, with a fierce rustle of his chart. "If you don't shut up..." "And at that," continued Beta, There is probably a route right through, straight as a meridian of longitude. Yeah? Well, in the first place, dimwit, it probably took 500 ships 500 years to work out that route by hit and miss. And my lousy half-credit charts don't give it. Besides, maybe those straight routes are a good thing to avoid. They're probably choked up with ships. And besides... Oh, for galaxy's sake, stop driveling and slavering so much righteous indignation. Her hands were in his hair. He yowled, "Ouch! Let go!" seized her wrists and whipped downward, whereupon Toran, Beta, and Chair formed a tangled threesome on the floor. It degenerated into a panting wrestling match, composed mostly of choking laughter and various foul blows. Toran broke loose at Magnifico's breathless entrance. "What is it?" The lines of anxiety puckered the clown's face and tightened the skin whitely over the enormous bridge of his nose. "The instruments are behaving queerly, sir. I have not, in the knowledge of my ignorance, touched anything." In 2 seconds, Toran was in the pilot room. He said quietly to Magnifico, "Wake up Ebling Miz. Have him come down here." He said to Beta, who was trying to get a basic order back to her hair by use of her fingers, "We've been detected, Bay." "Detected?" And Beta's arms dropped. "By whom?"
"Galaxy knows," muttered Toran. "But I imagine by someone with blasters already ranged and trained."
He sat down, and in a low voice was already sending into the sub-ether the ship's identification code. And when Ebling Miz entered, bathrobed and blear-eyed, Toran said with a desperate calm, "It seems we are inside the borders of a local inner kingdom, which is called the Autarchy of Philia."
"Never heard of it," said Miz abruptly.
"Well, neither did I," replied Toran. "But we're being stopped by a Philian ship just the same, and I don't know what it will involve." The captain inspector of the Philian ship crowded aboard with 6 armed men following him. He was short, thin-haired, thin-lipped, and dry-skinned. He coughed a sharp cough as he sat down and threw open the folio under his arm to a blank page. "Your passports and ship's clearance, please."
"We have none," said Toran.
"None, hey?" He snatched up a microphone suspended from his belt and spoke into it quickly. 3 men and 1 woman. Papers not in order." He made an accompanying notation in the folio. He said, "Where are you from?"
"Siwena," said Toran warily.
"Where is that?"
100,000 parsecs, 80 degrees west of Trantor. 40 degrees...
"Never mind, never mind." Toran could see that his inquisitor had written down, "Point of origin, periphery." The Philian continued. "Where are you going?"
Toran said.
"Trantor sector."
"Purpose?"
"Pleasure trip."
"Carrying any cargo?"
"No."
"Mm-hmm. We'll check on that."
He nodded, and 2 men jumped to activity. Toran made no move to interfere. "What brings you into Philian territory?" The Philian's eyes gleamed unamiably.
"We didn't know we were. I lack a proper chart."
"You will be required to pay 100 credits for that lack, and of course the usual fees required for tariff duties, etc." He spoke again into the microphone, but listened more than he spoke. Then to Toran. "Know anything about atomic technology?"
"A little," replied Toran guardedly.
"Yes?" The Philian closed his folio and added, "The men of the periphery have a knowledgeable reputation that way. Put on a suit and come with me." Beta stepped forward. "What are you going to do with him?"
Toran put her gently aside and asked coldly, "Where do you want me to come?"
"Our power plant needs minor adjustments. He'll come with you." His pointing finger aimed directly at Magnifico, whose brown eyes opened wide in a blubbery dismay.
"What's he got to do with it?" demanded Toran fiercely.
The official looked up coldly. "I am informed of pirate activities in this vicinity. A description of one of the known thugs tallies roughly. It is a purely routine matter of identification."
Toran hesitated, but 6 men and 6 blasters are eloquent arguments. He reached into the cupboard for the suits.
An hour later, he rose upright in the bowels of the Philian ship and raged, "There's not a thing wrong with the motors that I can see. The bus bars are true, the L-tubes are feeding properly, and the reaction analysis checks. Who's in charge here?"
The head engineer said quietly,
"I am."
"Well, get me out of here." He was led to the officer's level, and the small anteroom held only an indifferent ensign. "Where's the man who came with me?" "Please wait," said the ensign. It was 15 minutes later that Magnifico was brought in. "What did they do to you?" asked Toran quickly.
"Nothing. Nothing at all."
Magnifico's head shook a slow negative. It took 250 credits to fulfill the demands of Felia, 50 credits of it for instant release, and they were in free space again. Beta said with a forced laugh, "Don't we raid an escort? Don't we get the usual figurative boot over the border?" And Toran replied grimly, "That was no Felian ship, and we're not leaving for a while. Come in here." They gathered about him. He said whitely, "That was a Foundation ship, and those were the Mule's men aboard." Ebling bent to pick up the cigar he had dropped. He said, "Here, we're 30,000 parsecs from the Foundation. And we're here. What's to prevent them from making the same trip? Galaxy, Ebling, don't you think I can tell ships apart? I saw their engines, and that's enough for me. I tell you, it was a Foundation engine in a Foundation ship." "And how did they get here?" asked Beta logically. "What are the chances of a random meeting of two given ships in space?" "What's that to do with it?" demanded Toran hotly. "It would only show we've been followed." "Followed?" hooted Beta. "Through hyperspace?" Ebling Miss interposed wearily. "That can be done, given a good ship and a great pilot. But the possibility doesn't impress me." "I haven't been masking my trail," insisted Toran. "I've been building up takeoff speed on the straight. A blind man could have calculated our route." "The blazes he could," cried Beta. "With the cockeyed jumps you're making, observing our initial direction didn't mean a thing. We came out of the jump wrong end forwards more than once." "We're wasting time," blazed Toran with gritted teeth. "It's a Foundation ship under the Mule. It stopped us. It searched us. It's had Magnifico, alone, with me as hostage to keep the rest of you quiet in case you suspected. And we're going to burn it out of space right now." "Hold on now," and Ebling Miss clutched at him. "Are you going to destroy us for one ship you think is an enemy? Think, man. Would those scuppers chase us over an impossible route half through the bestinkered galaxy, look us over, and then let us go? They're still interested in where we're going. Then why stop us and put us on our guard? You can't have it both ways, you know."
"I'll have it my way. Let go of me, Ebling, or I'll knock you down."
Magnifico leaned forward from his balanced perch on his favorite chair back. His long nostrils flared with excitement.
"I crave your pardon for my interruption, but my poor mind is of a sudden plagued with a queer thought."
Beta anticipated Toran's gesture of annoyance and added her grip to Ebling's.
"Go ahead and speak, Magnifico. We will all listen faithfully."
Magnifico said, "In my stay in their ship, what addled wits I have were bemazed and bemused by a chattering fear that befell me. Of a truth, I have a lack of memory of most that happened. Many men staring at me, and talk I did not understand. But towards the last, as though a beam of sunlight had dashed through a cloud rift, there was a face I knew. A glimpse, the merest glimmer, and yet it glows in my memory ever stronger and brighter."
Toran said, "Who was it?"
"That captain who was with us so long a time ago, when first you saved me from slavery." It had obviously been Magnifico's intention to create a sensation, and the delighted smile that curled broadly in the shadow of his proboscis attested to his realization of the intention's success.
"Captain Han Pritcher?" demanded Miz sternly. "You're sure of that? Certain sure now?"
"Sir, I swear," and he laid a bone-thin hand upon his narrow chest. "I would uphold the truth of it before the Mule and swear it in his teeth, though all his power were behind him to deny it." Beta said in pure wonder, "Then what's it all about?" The clown faced her eagerly. "My lady, I have a theory. It came upon me, ready-made, as though the galactic spirit had gently laid it in my mind." He actually raised his voice above Toran's interrupting objection. "My lady," he addressed himself exclusively to Beta, "if this captain had, like us, escaped with a ship, if he, like us, were on a trip for a purpose of his own devising, if he blundered upon us,
He would suspect us of following and waylaying him, as we suspected him of the like. What wonder he played this comedy to enter our ship? Why would he want us in his ship, then? Demanded Turan. That doesn't fit. Why, yes, it does, clamored the clown with a flowing inspiration. He sent an underling who knew us not, but who described us into his microphone. The listening captain would be struck at my own poor likeness. For of a truth, there are not many in this great galaxy who bear a resemblance to my scantiness. I was the proof of the identity of the rest of you. And so he leaves us? What do we know of this mission and the secrecy thereof? He has spied us out for not an enemy, and having it done so, must he needs think it wise to risk his plan by widening the knowledge thereof? Beta said slowly, Don't be stubborn, Tori. It does explain things. It could be, agreed Miz. Turan seemed helpless in the face of united resistance. Something in the clown's fluent explanations bothered him. Something was wrong. Yet he was bewildered, and in spite of himself, his anger ebbed. For a while, he whispered, I thought we might have had one of the mule ships. And his eyes were dark with the pain of Haven's loss. The others understood. Chapter 22. Death on Neo Trantor. Neo Trantor, the small planet of Delicas, renamed after the Great Sack, was for nearly a century the seat of the last dynasty of the First Empire. It was a shadow world and a shadow empire, and its existence is only of legalistic importance. Under the first of the Neo-Trantorian dynasty, Encyclopedia Galactica. Neo-Trantor was the name, New Trantor, and when you have said the name, you have exhausted at a stroke all the resemblances of the old Trantor to the great original. 2 parsecs away, the sun of old Trantor still shone, and the galaxy's imperial capital of the previous century still cut through space in the silent and eternal repetition of its orbit. Men even inhabited old Trantor. Not many, 100 million perhaps, where 50 years before 40 billions had swarmed. The huge metal world was in jagged splinters. The towering thrusts of the multi-towers from the single world-girdling base were torn and empty, still bearing the original blast holes and fire gut, shards of the great sack of 40 years earlier. It was strange that a world which had been the center of a galaxy for 12,000 years, that had ruled limitless space and been home to legislators and rulers whose whims spanned the parsecs, could die in a month. It was strange that a world which had been untouched through the vast conquering sweeps and retreats of a millennium, and equally untouched by the civil wars and palace revolutions of another millennium, should lie dead at last. It was strange that the glory of the galaxy should be a rotting corpse, and pathetic. For centuries would yet pass before the mighty works of 50 generations of humans would decay past use. Only the declining powers of men themselves rendered them useless now. The millions left after the billions had died tore up the gleaming metal base of the planet and exposed soil that had not felt the touch of sun in 1,000 years. Surrounded by the mechanical perfections of human efforts, encircled by the industrial marvels of mankind, freed of the tyranny of environment, they returned to the land. In the huge traffic clearings, wheat and corn grew. In the shadow of the towers, sheep grazed. But Neo Trantor existed, an obscure village of a planet drowned in the shadow of mighty Trantor, until a heart-throttled royal family, racing before the fire and flame of the great sack, sped to it as its last refuge, and held out there barely until the roaring wave of rebellion subsided. There it ruled in ghostly splendor over a cadaverous remnant of Imperium. 20 agricultural worlds were a galactic empire. Dagobert IX, ruler of 20 worlds of refractory squires and sullen peasants, was emperor of the galaxy, lord of the universe. Dagobert IX had been 25 on the bloody day he arrived with his father upon Neo Trantor. His eyes and mind were still alive with the glory and the power of the empire that was. But his son, who might one day be Dagobert X, was born on Neo Trantor. 20 worlds were all he knew. Jord Comison's open-air car was the finest vehicle of its type on all Neo Trantor. And after all, justly so,
It did not end with the fact that Commison was the largest landowner on Neo-Trantor. It began there. For in earlier days, he had been the companion and evil genius of a young crown prince, restive in the dominating grip of a middle-aged emperor. And now he was the companion and still the evil genius of a middle-aged crown prince who hated and dominated an old emperor. So Jord Commison, in his air car, which in mother-of-pearl finish and gold and Lumitron ornamentation needed no coat of arms as owner's identification, surveyed the lands that were his, and the miles of rolling wheat that were his, and the huge threshers and harvesters that were his, and the tenant farmers and machine tenders that were his, and considered his problems cautiously. Beside him, his bent and withered chauffeur guided the ship gently through the upper winds and smiled. Jord Commison spoke to the wind, the air, and the sky. "You remember what I told you, Inchney?" Inchney's thin gray hair wisped lightly in the wind. His gape-toothed smile widened in its thin-lipped fashion, and the vertical wrinkles of his cheeks deepened as though he were keeping an eternal secret from himself. The whisper of his voice whistled between his teeth. "I remember, sire, and I have thought..." "And what have you thought, Inchney?" There was an impatience about the question. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. "I remember, sire, and I have thought..." "And what have you thought, Inchney?" There was an impatience about the question. Inchney remembered that he had been young and handsome, and a lord on old Trantor. Inchney remembered that he was a disfigured ancient on Neo-Trantor, who lived by grace of Squire Jord Commison, and paid for the grace by lending his subtlety on request. He sighed very softly. He whispered again, "Visitors from the Foundation, sire, are a convenient thing to have, especially, sire, when they come with but a single ship and but a single fighting man. How welcome they might be."
"Welcome?" said Commison gloomily. "Perhaps so. But those men are magicians and may be powerful."
"Puh," muttered Inchney. "The mistiness of distance hides the truth. The Foundation is but a world. Its citizens are but men. If you blast them, they die."
Inchney held the ship on its course. A river was a winding sparkle below. He whispered,
"And is there not a man they speak of now who stirs the worlds of the periphery?"
Commison was suddenly suspicious. "What do you know of this?" There was no smile on his chauffeur's face.
"Nothing, sire. It was but an idle question."
The squire's hesitation was short. He said with brutal directness, "Nothing you ask is idle, and your method of acquiring knowledge will have your scrawny neck in a vice yet. But have it. This man is called the Mule, and a subject of his had been here some months ago on a matter of business. I await another now for its conclusion."
"And these newcomers, they are not the ones you want, perhaps?"
"They lack the identification they should have."
"It has been reported that the Foundation has been captured."
"I did not tell you that."
"It has been so reported," continued Inchney coolly. "And if that is correct, then these may be refugees from the destruction, and may be held for the Mule's man out of honest friendship."
"Yes?" Commison was uncertain.
"And, sire, since it is well known that the friend of a conqueror is but the last victim, it would be but a measure of honest self-defense. For there are such things as psychic probes, and here we have four Foundation brains. There is much about the Foundation it would be useful to know. Much even about the Mule. And then the Mule's friendship would be a trifle the less overpowering."
Commison, in the quiet of the upper air, returned with a shiver to his first thought. "But if the Foundation has not fallen, if the reports are lies, it is said that it has been foretold it cannot fall."
"We are past the age of soothsayers, sire."
"And yet if it did not fall, Inchney, think. If it did not fall... The Mule made me promises. Indeed..." He had gone too far and backtracked. "That is, he made boasts. But boasts are wind and deeds are hard." Inchney laughed noiselessly.
"Deeds are hard indeed until begun. One could scarcely find a further fear than a galaxy-end Foundation."
"There is still the Prince," murmured Commison almost to himself.
"He deals with the Mule also, then, sire?"
Commison could not quite choke down the complacent shift of features. Not entirely. Not as I do. But he grows wilder, more uncontrollable. A demon is upon him. If I seize these people and he takes them away for his own use, for he does not lack a certain shrewdness, I am not yet ready to quarrel with him. He frowned, and his heavy cheeks bent downwards with dislike.
I saw those strangers for a few moments yesterday, said the gray chauffeur irrelevantly. And it is a strange woman, that dark one. She walks with the freedom of a man, and she is of a startling paleness against the dark luster of hair.
There was almost a warmth in the husky whisper of the withered voice, so that Commison turned toward him in sudden surprise. Inchney continued,
The prince, I think, would not find his shrewdness proof against a reasonable compromise. You could have the rest if you left him the girl.
A light broke upon Commison. A thought, indeed a thought. Inchney, turn back. And Inchney, if all turns well, we will discuss further this matter of your freedom. It was an almost superstitious sense of symbolism that Commison found a personal capsule waiting for him in his private study when he returned. It had arrived by a wavelength known to few. Commison smiled a fat smile. The mule's man was coming, and the foundation had indeed fallen. Beta's misty visions, when she had them, of an imperial palace, did not jibe with the reality, and inside her there was a vague sense of disappointment. The room was small, almost plain, almost ordinary. The palace did not even match the mayor's residence back at the foundation. And Dagobert the Ninth, Beta had definite ideas of what an emperor ought to look like. He ought not look like somebody's benevolent grandfather. He ought not be thin and white and faded, or serving cups of tea with his own hand in an expressed anxiety for the comfort of his visitors. But so it was. Dagobert the Ninth chuckled as he poured tea into her stiffly outheld cup.
This is a great pleasure for me, my dear. It is a moment away from ceremony and courtiers. I have not had the opportunity for welcoming visitors from my outer provinces for a time now. My son takes care of these details now that I'm older. You haven't met my son. A fine boy. Headstrong, perhaps. But then he's young. Do you care for a flavor capsule? No?
Turan attempted an interruption. Your Imperial Majesty.
Yes?
Your Imperial Majesty, it has not been our intention to intrude upon you.
Nonsense, there is no intrusion. Tonight there will be the official reception, but until then we are free. Let's see, where did you say you were from? It seems a long time since we had an official reception. You said you were from the province of Anacreon?
From the Foundation, Your Imperial Majesty.
Yes, the Foundation, I remember now. I had it located. It is in the province of Anacreon. I've never been there. My doctor forbids extensive traveling. I don't recall any recent reports from my viceroy at Anacreon. How are conditions there? He concluded anxiously.
Sire, mumbled Turan, I bring no complaints.
That is gratifying. I will commend my viceroy.
Turan looked helplessly at Ebling Miz, whose brusque voice rose.
Sir, we have been told that it will require your permission for us to visit the Imperial University Library on Trantor.
Trantor?
Questioned the Emperor mildly.
Trantor?
Then a look of puzzled pain crossed his thin face.
Trantor, he whispered. I remember now. I am making plans now to return there with a flood of ships at my back. You shall come with me. Together we will destroy the rebel Gilmer. Together we shall restore the Empire.
His bent back had straightened. His voice had strengthened. For a moment his eyes were hard. Then he blinked and said softly,
But Gilmer is dead. I seem to remember... Yes, Gilmer is dead. Trantor is dead. For a moment it seemed... Where was it you said you came from?
Magnifico whispered to Beta, Is this really an emperor? For somehow I thought emperors were greater and wiser than ordinary men. Beta motioned him quiet. She said, If your Imperial Majesty would but sign an order permitting us to go to Trantor, it would avail greatly the common cause.
To Trantor?
The emperor was blank and uncomprehending. Sire, the viceroy of Anacreon, in whose name we speak, sends word that Gilmer is yet alive.
Alive! Alive! Thundered Dagobert.
Where?
It will be war.
Your Imperial Majesty, it must not yet be known. His whereabouts are uncertain. The Viceroy sends us to acquaint you of the fact, and it is only on Trantor that we may find his hiding place. Once discovered, yes, yes, he must be found. The old Emperor doddered to the wall and touched the little photo cell with a trembling finger. He muttered, after an ineffectual pause, "My servants do not come. I cannot wait for them." He was scribbling on a blank sheet and ended with a flourished D. He said, "Gilmer will yet learn the power of his Emperor. Where was it you came from? Anacreon? What are the conditions there? Is the name of the Emperor powerful?" Beta took the paper from his loose fingers. "Your Imperial Majesty is beloved by the people. Your love for them is widely known. I shall have to visit my good people of Anacreon, but my doctor says... I don't remember what he says, but..." He looked up, his old gray eyes sharp. "Were you saying something of Gilmer?" "No, Your Imperial Majesty. He shall not advance further. Go back and tell your people that. Trantor shall hold. My father leads the fleet now, and the rebel vermin Gilmer shall freeze in space with his regicidal rabble." He staggered into a seat, and his eyes were blank once more. What was I saying? Taran rose and bowed low. "Your Imperial Majesty has been kind to us, but the time allotted to us for an audience is over." For a moment, Dagobert the Ninth looked like an emperor indeed, as he rose and stood stiff-backed, while one by one his visitors retreated backward through the door, to where 20 armed men intervened and locked a circle about them. A hand weapon flashed. To Beta, consciousness returned sluggishly, but without the where-am-I sensation. She remembered clearly the odd old man who called himself Emperor, and the other men who waited outside. The arthritic tingle in her finger joints meant a stun pistol. She kept her eyes closed and listened with painful attention to the voices. There were two of them. One was slow and cautious, with the slyness beneath the surface obsequity. The other was hoarse and thick, almost sodden, and blurted out in vicious spurts. Beta liked neither. The thick voice was predominant. Beta caught the last words. "He will live forever, that old madman. It wearies me. It annoys me. Commerson, I will have it. I grow older, too. Your Highness, let us first see of what use these people are. It may be we shall have sources of strength other than your father still provides." The thick voice was lost in a bubbling whisper. Beta caught only the phrase, "the girl." But the other fawning voice was a nasty, low, running chuckle, followed by a comradely, near-patronizing, "Dagobert, you do not age. They lie who say you are not a youth of 20. They laughed together, and Beta's blood was an icy trickle. "Dagobert, your Highness." The old emperor had spoken of a headstrong son, and the implication of the whispers now beat dully upon her. But such things didn't happen to people in real life. Taran's voice broke upon her in a slow, hard current of cursing. She opened her eyes, and Taran's, which were upon her, showed open relief. He said fiercely, "This banditry will be answered by the Emperor. Release us!" It dawned upon Beta that her wrists and ankles were fastened to wall and floor by a tight attraction field. Thick voice approached Taran. He was paunchy. His lower eyelids puffed darkly, and his hair was thinning out. There was a gay feather in his peaked hat, and the edging of his doublet was embroidered with silvery metal foam. He sneered with heavy amusement. "The Emperor? The poor, mad Emperor? I have his pass. No subject may hinder our freedom." "But I am no subject, space garbage. I am the regent and crown prince, and am to be addressed as such. As for my poor, silly father, it amuses him to see visitors occasionally, and we humor him. It tickles his mock imperial fancy. But of course it has no other meaning." And then he was before Beta, and she looked up at him contemptuously. He leaned close, and his breath was overpoweringly minted. He said, "Her eyes suit well, Commerson. She is even prettier with them open. I think she'll do. It will be an exotic dish for a jaded taste, eh?" There was a futile surge upwards on Taran's part, which the Crown Prince ignored. and Beta felt the iciness travel outward to the skin. Ebling Miz was still out, head lolling weakly upon his chest, but with a sensation of surprise, Beta noticed that Magnifico's eyes were open, sharply open, as though awake for many minutes. Those large brown eyes swiveled towards Beta and stared at her out of a doughy face. He whimpered and nodded with his head towards the Crown Prince.
"That one has my visi-sonar."
The Crown Prince turned sharply toward the new voice.
"This is yours, monster?"
He swung the instrument from his shoulder where it had hung, suspended by its green strap, unnoticed by Beta. He fingered it clumsily, tried to sound a chord, and got nothing for his pains.
"Can you play it, monster?"
Magnifico nodded once. Toran said suddenly, "You've rifled a ship of the Foundation. If the Emperor will not avenge, the Foundation will." It was the other, Commison, who answered slowly,
"What Foundation? Or is the mule no longer the mule?"
There was no answer to that. The prince's grin showed large, uneven teeth. The clown's binding field was broken, and he was nudged urgently to his feet. The visi-sonar was thrust into his hand.
"Play for us, monster," said the prince. "Play us a serenade of love and beauty for our foreign lady here. Tell her that my father's country prison is no palace, but that I can take her to one where she can swim in rose water and know what a prince's love is. Sing of a prince's love, monster."
He placed one thick thigh upon a marble table and swung a leg idly, while his fatuous smiling stare swept Beta into a silent rage. Taran's sinews strained against the field in painful, perspiring effort. Ebling Miz stirred and moaned. Magnifico gasped,
"My fingers are of useless stiffness. Play, monster!" roared the prince.
The lights dimmed at a gesture to Commison, and in the dimness he crossed his arms and waited. Magnifico drew his fingers in rapid rhythmic jumps from end to end of the multi-keyed instrument, and a sharp, gliding rainbow of light jumped across the room. A low, soft tone sounded, throbbing, tearful. It lifted in sad laughter, and underneath it there sounded a dull tolling. The darkness seemed to intensify and grow thick. Music reached Beta through the muffled folds of invisible blankets. Gleaming light reached her from the depths as though a single candle glowed at the bottom of a pit. Automatically, her eyes strained. The light brightened, but remained blurred. It moved fuzzily, in confused color, and the music was suddenly brassy, evil, flourishing in high crescendo. The light flickered quickly, in soft motion to the wicked rhythm. Something writhed within the light. Something with poisonous metallic scales writhed and yawned, and the music writhed and yawned with it. Beta struggled with a strange emotion, and then caught herself in a mental gasp. Almost it reminded her of the time in the time vault, of those last days on Haven. It was that horrible, cloying, clinging spiderweb of horror and despair. She shrunk beneath it, oppressed. The music dinned upon her, laughing horribly, and the writhing terror at the wrong end of the telescope in the small circle of light was lost as she turned feverishly away. Her forehead was wet and cold. The music died. It must have lasted 15 minutes, and a vast pleasure at its absence flooded Beta. Light glared, and Magnifico's face was close to hers, sweaty, wild-eyed, lugubrious.
"My lady," he gasped, "how fare you?"
"Well enough," she whispered.
"But why did you play like that?"
She became aware of the others in the room. Toran and Miz were limp and helpless against the wall, but her eyes skimmed over them. There was the prince, lying strangely still at the foot of the table. There was Commison, moaning wildly through an open, drooling mouth. Commison flinched and yelled mindlessly as Magnifico took a step towards him. Magnifico turned and, with a leap, turned the others loose. Taran lunged upwards and, with eager, taut fists, seized the landowner by the neck.
"You come with us. We'll want you to make sure we get to our ship."
2 hours later, in the ship's kitchen, Beta served a walloping homemade pie, and Magnifico celebrated the return to space by attacking it with a magnificent disregard of table manners.
"Good, Magnifico?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Magnifico?"
"Yep, my lady?"
"What was it you played back there?"
The clown writhed.
I'd rather not say. I learned it once, and the visi-sonar is of an effect upon the nervous system most profound.
surely it was an evil thing, and not for your sweet innocence, my lady.
Oh, come now, Magnifico. I'm not as innocent as that. Don't flatter so.
Did I see anything like what they saw?
I hope not. I played it for them only.
If you saw, it was but the rim of it, from afar.
And that was enough. Do you know you knocked the prince out?
Magnifico spoke grimly through a large, muffling piece of pie.
I killed him, my lady.
What?
She swallowed painfully.
He was dead when I stopped, or I would have continued.
I cared not for Commison. His greatest threat was death or torture. But, my lady, this prince looked upon you wickedly, and...
He choked in a mixture of indignation and embarrassment. Beta felt strange thoughts come and repressed them sternly.
Magnifico, you've got a gallant soul.
Oh, my lady.
He bent a red nose into his pie, but somehow did not eat. Ebling Miss stared out the port. Trantor was near, its metallic shine fearfully bright. Toran was standing there, too. He said with dull bitterness,
We've come for nothing, Ebling. The mule's man precedes us.
Ebling Miz rubbed his forehead with a hand that seemed shriveled out of its former plumpness. His voice was an abstracted mutter. Toran was annoyed.
I say those people know the foundation has fallen.
I say, huh? Miz looked up, puzzled. Then he placed a gentle hand upon Toran's wrist, in complete oblivion of any previous conversation.
Toran, I've been looking at Trantor. Do you know, I have the queerest feeling ever since we arrived on Neo Trantor. It's an urge, a drive that's pushing and pushing inside. Toran, I can do it. I know I can do it. Things are becoming clear in my mind. They have never been so clear.
Toran stared and shrugged. The words brought him no confidence. He said tentatively,
Miz?
Yes?
You didn't see a ship come down on Neo Trantor as we left?
Consideration was brief.
No.
I did. Imagination, I suppose. But it could have been that Felian ship.
The one with Captain Han Pritcher on it?
The one with Space Knows Who upon it? Magnifico's information.
It followed us here, Miz.
Ebling Miz said nothing. Toran said strenuously,
Is there anything wrong with you? Aren't you well?
Miz's eyes were thoughtful, luminous, and strange. He did not answer. Chapter 23, The Ruins of Trantor. The location of an objective upon the great world of Trantor presents a problem unique in the galaxy. There are no continents or oceans to locate from 1,000 miles distance. There are no rivers, lakes, and islands to catch sight of through the cloud rifts. The metal-covered world had been, one colossal city, and only the old Imperial Palace could be identified readily from outer space by a stranger. The Beta circled the world at almost air-car height in repeated painful search. From polar regions, where the icy coating of the metal spires were somber evidence of the breakdown or neglect of the weather-conditioning machinery, they worked southwards. Occasionally, they could experiment with the correlations, or presumable correlations, between what they saw and what the inadequate map obtained at Neo Trantor showed. But it was unmistakable when it came. The gap in the metal coat of the planet was 50 miles. The unusual greenery spread over hundreds of square miles, enclosing the mighty grace of the ancient imperial residences. The Beta hovered and slowly oriented itself. There were only the huge supercauseways to guide them. Long, straight arrows on the map. Smooth, gleaming ribbons there below them. What the map indicated to be the university area was reached by dead reckoning, and upon the flat area of what once must have been a busy landing field, the ship lowered itself. It was only as they submerged into the welter of metal that the smooth beauty apparent from the air dissolved into the broken, twisted near-wreckage that had been left in the wake of the sack. Spires were truncated, smooth walls gouted and twisted, and just for an instant there was the glimpse of a shaven area of earth, perhaps several hundred acres in extent, dark and plowed. Lee Center waited as the ship settled downward cautiously. It was a strange ship, not from Neo Trantor, and inwardly he sighed. Strange ships and confused dealings with the men of outer space
could mean the end of the short days of peace, a return to the old grandiose times of death and battle. Center was leader of the group. The old books were in his charge, and he had read of those old days. He did not want them. Perhaps 10 minutes spent themselves as the strange ship came down to nestle upon the flatness, but long memories telescoped themselves in that time. There was first the great farm of his childhood. That remained in his mind merely as busy crowds of people. Then there was the trek of the young families to new lands. He was 10 then, an only child, puzzled and frightened. Then the new buildings, the great metal slabs to be uprooted and torn aside, the exposed soil to be turned and freshened and invigorated, neighboring buildings to be torn down and leveled, others to be transformed into living quarters. There were crops to be grown and harvested, peaceful relations with neighboring farms to be established. There was growth and expansion, and the quiet efficiency of self-rule. There was the coming of a new generation of hard little youngsters born to the soil. There was the great day when he was chosen leader of the group, and for the first time since his 18th birthday, he did not shave and saw the first stubble of his leader's beard appear. And now the galaxy might intrude and put an end to the brief idyll of isolation. The ship landed. He watched wordlessly as the port opened. 4 emerged, cautious and watchful. There were 3 men, varied, old, young, thin, and beaked, and a woman striding among them like an equal. His hand left the 2 glassy black tufts of his beard as he stepped forward. He gave the universal gesture of peace. Both hands were before him, hard, calloused palms upward. The young man approached 2 steps and duplicated the gesture. "I come on peace." The accent was strange, but the words were understandable and welcome. He replied deeply, "In peace be it. You are welcome to the hospitality of the group. Are you hungry? You shall eat. Are you thirsty? You shall drink." Slowly the reply came. "We thank you for your kindness and shall bear good report of your group when we return to our world." A queer answer, but good. Behind him, the men of the group were smiling, and from the recesses of the surrounding structures, the women emerged. In his own quarters, he removed the locked, mirror-walled box from its hidden place and offered each of the guests the long, plump cigars that were reserved for great occasions. Before the woman, he hesitated. She had taken a seat among the men. The strangers evidently allowed, even expected, such effrontery. Stiffly, he offered the box. She accepted one with a smile and drew in its aromatic smoke with all the relish one could expect. Lee Center repressed a scandalized emotion. The stiff conversation, in advance of the meal, touched politely upon the subject of farming on Trantor. It was the old man who asked, "What about hydroponics? Surely for such a world as Trantor, hydroponics would be the answer." Center shook his head slowly. He felt uncertain. His knowledge was the unfamiliar matter of the books he had read. "Artificial farming in chemicals, I think. No, not on Trantor. This hydroponics requires a world of industry. For instance, a great chemical industry. And in war or disaster, when industry breaks down, the people starve. Nor can all foods be grown artificially. Some lose their food value. The soil is still cheaper, still better, always more dependable." "And your food supply is sufficient?" "Sufficient. Perhaps monotonous. We have fowl that supply eggs and milk yielders for our dairy products. But our meat supply rests upon our foreign trade." "Trade?" The young man seemed roused to sudden interest. "You trade, then. But what do you export?" "Metal," was the curt answer. "Look for yourself. We have an infinite supply, ready processed. They come from Neo Trantor with ships, demolish an indicated area, increasing our growing space, and leave us in exchange meat, canned fruit, food concentrates, farm machinery, and so on. They carry off the metal and both sides profit." They feasted on bread and cheese and a vegetable stew that was unreservedly delicious. It was over the dessert of frosted fruit, the only imported item on the menu, that for the first time the outlanders became other than mere guests. The young man produced a map of Trantor. Calmly, Lee Center studied it. He listened and said gravely, "The university grounds are a static area. We farmers do not grow crops on it. We do not, by preference, even enter it. It is one of our few relics of another time we would keep undisturbed. We are seekers after knowledge. We would disturb nothing. Our ship would be our hostage. The old man offered this eagerly, feverishly. I can take you there, then, said Center. That night the strangers slept, and that night Lee Center sent a message to Neo Trantor. This book is concluded on cassette number 8. I can take you there, then, said Center. That night the strangers slept, and that night Lee Center sent a message to Neo Trantor. Chapter 24. Convert. The thin life of Trantor trickled to nothing when they entered among the wide-spaced buildings of the university grounds. There was a solemn and lonely silence over it. The strangers of the Foundation knew nothing of the swirling days and nights of the bloody sack that had left the university untouched. They knew nothing of the time after the collapse of the imperial power, when the students, with their borrowed weapons and their pale-faced, inexperienced bravery, formed a protective volunteer army to protect the central shrine of the science of the galaxy. They knew nothing of the 7 days' fight and the armistice that kept the university free, when even the imperial palace clanged with the boots of Gilmer and his soldiers during the short interval of their rule. Those of the Foundation, approaching for the first time, realized only that in a world of transition from a gutted old to a strenuous new, this area was a quiet, graceful museum piece of ancient greatness. They were intruders, in a sense. The brooding emptiness rejected them. The academic atmosphere seemed still to live and to stir angrily at the disturbance. The library was a deceptively small building which broadened out vastly underground into a mammoth volume of silence and reverie. Ebling Miz paused before the elaborate murals of the reception room. He whispered, one had to whisper here, I think we passed the catalog rooms back away. I'll stop there. His forehead was flushed, his hand trembling. I mustn't be disturbed, Toran. Will you bring my meals down to me? Anything you say. We'll do all we can to help. Do you want us to work under you? No, I must be alone. You think you will get what you want? And Ebling Miz replied with a soft certainty, I know I will. Toran and Beta came closer to setting up housekeeping in normal fashion than at any time in their year of married life. It was a strange sort of housekeeping. They lived in the middle of grandeur with an inappropriate simplicity. Their food was drawn largely from Lee Center's farm and was paid for in the little atomic gadgets that may be found on any trader's ship. Magnifico taught himself how to use the projectors in the library reading room and sat over adventure novels and romances to the point where he was almost as forgetful of meals and sleep as was Ebling Miz. Ebling himself was completely buried. He had insisted on a hammock being slung up for him in the psychology reference room. His face grew thin and white. His vigor of speech was lost, and his favorite curses had died a mild death. There were times when the recognition of either Toran or Beta seemed a struggle. He was more himself with Magnifico, who brought him his meals, and often sat watching him for hours at a time, with a queer, fascinated absorption, as the aging psychologist transcribed endless equations, cross-referred to endless book films, scurried endlessly about in a wild mental effort towards an end he alone saw. Toran came upon her in the darkened room and said sharply, Beta. Beta started guiltily. Yes, you want me, Tori? Sure I want you. What in space are you sitting there for? You've been acting all wrong since we got to Trantor. What's the matter with you? Oh, Tori, stop, she said wearily. And, oh, Tori, stop, he mimicked impatiently. Then with sudden softness, won't you tell me what's wrong, Bay? Something's bothering you. No, nothing is, Tori. If you keep on just nagging and nagging, you'll have me mad. I'm just thinking. Thinking about what? About nothing. Well, about the mule and Haven and the Foundation and everything. About Ebling Miz and whether he'll find anything about the second Foundation and whether it'll help us when he does find it and a million other things. Are you satisfied? Her voice was agitated. If you're just brooding, do you mind stopping? It isn't pleasant, and it doesn't help the situation. Beta got to her feet and smiled weakly. All right, I'm happy,
See, I'm smiling and jolly. Magnifico's voice was an agitated cry outside. My lady! What is it? Come... Beta's voice choked off sharply when the opening door framed the large, hard-faced... Pritcher! Cried Toran. Beta gasped. Captain, how did you find us? Han Pritcher stepped inside. His voice was clear and level, and utterly dead of feeling. My rank is colonel now, under the mule. Under the mule? Toran's voice trailed off. They formed a tableau there, the three. Magnifico stared wildly and shrank behind Toran. Nobody stopped to notice him. Beta said, her hands trembling in each other's tight grasp, You are arresting us? You have really gone over to them? The colonel replied quickly, I have not come to arrest you. My instructions make no mention of you. With regard to you, I am free, and I choose to exercise our old friendship, if you will let me. Toran's face was a twisted suppression of fury. How did you find us? You were in the Felian ship then. You followed us? The wooden lack of expression on Pritchard's face might have flickered in embarrassment. I was on the Felian ship. I met you in the first place, well, by chance. It is a chance that is mathematically impossible. No, simply rather improbable, so my statement will have to stand. In any case, you admitted to the Felian, there is, of course, no such nation as Felia actually, that you were heading for the Trantor sector, and since the mule already has his contacts upon Neo-Trantor, it was easy to have you detained there. Unfortunately, you got away before I arrived, but not long before. I had time to have the farms on Trantor ordered to report your arrival. It was done, and I am here. May I sit down? I come in friendliness, believe me. He sat. Toran bent his head and thought futilely. With a numbed lack of emotion, Beta prepared tea. Toran looked up harshly. Well, what are you waiting for, Colonel? What's your friendship? If it's not arrest, what is it then? Protective custody? Call in your men and give your orders. Patiently, Pritcher shook his head. No, Toran. I come of my own will to speak to you, to persuade you of the uselessness of what you are doing. If I fail, I shall leave. That is all. That is all. Well, then peddle your propaganda, give us your speech, and leave. I don't want any tea, Beta. Pritcher accepted a cup, with a grave word of thanks. He looked at Toran with a clear strength as he sipped lightly. Then he said, The mule is a mutant. He cannot be beaten in the very nature of the mutation. Why? What is the mutation? Asked Toran with sour humor. I suppose you'll tell us now, huh? Yes, I will. Your knowledge won't hurt him. You see, he is capable of adjusting the emotional balance of human beings. Sounds like a little trick, but it's quite unbeatable. Beta broke in. The emotional balance? She frowned. Won't you explain that? I don't quite understand. I mean that it is an easy matter for him to instill into a capable general, say, the emotion of utter loyalty to the mule and complete belief in the mule's victory. His generals are emotionally controlled. They cannot betray him. They cannot weaken, and the control is permanent. His most capable enemies become his most faithful subordinates. The warlord of Kalgan surrenders his planet and becomes his viceroy for the Foundation. And you, added Beta bitterly, betray your cause and become the mule's envoy to Trantor. I see. I haven't finished. The mule's gift works in reverse even more effectively. Despair is an emotion. At the crucial moment, key men on the Foundation, key men on Haven, despaired. Their worlds fell without too much struggle. Do you mean to say, demanded Beta tensely, that the feeling I had in the time vault was the mule juggling my emotional control? Mine too. Everyone's. How was it on Haven towards the end? Beta turned away. Colonel Pritcher continued earnestly. As it works for worlds, so it works for individuals. Can you fight a force which can make you surrender willingly when it so desires? Can make you a faithful servant when it so desires? Toran said slowly, How do I know this is the truth? Can you explain the fall of the Foundation and of Haven otherwise? Can you explain my conversion otherwise? Think, man. What have you or I or the whole galaxy accomplished against the mule in all this time?
What one little thing?
Toran felt the challenge.
By the galaxy, I can. With a sudden touch of fierce satisfaction, he shouted, Your wonderful mule had contacts with Neo Trantor, you say, that were to have detained